Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the links emerging between the husband and wife terrorists in San Bernardino and Daesh, the self-declared Islamic State, and discuss both the role of Saudi Arabia and what local law enforcement have uncovered about the backgrounds and motives of the two shooters who killed 14 and wounded 21 last Wednesday. Brian Levin, the director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino, joins us to discuss what he has learned from those investigating the case, along with what was discussed in recent testimony he gave to the Congress's Homeland Security Subcommittee on Counterterrorism and Intelligence. Then we'll look further into the challenges to Homeland Security posed by the recent massacre in San Bernardino and speak with David Schanzer, professor of the practice and director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security at Duke University, who was the Democratic staff director for the House of Representatives Committee on Homeland Security. We will discuss the task President Obama has of calming the nation in his address tonight in a political environment where paranoia over terrorist acts will be exploited by nativist and racist right-wing politicians. Then finally, we'll go to Venezuela for an update on the congressional elections underway in a country torn by widespread frustration over shortages of staples and food, inflation, and crime. David Smaldi, a senior fellow at the Washington Office of Latin America, who has researched Venezuela for the past 20 years and have lived there for a total of 10 years, joins us. We will discuss the likelihood of an opposition victory due to President Maduro's spectacular mismanagement of the economy and his squandering of popular support for his successors, for his predecessors, Hugo Chavez's Bolivarian Revolution. And joining us now is Brian Levin, a criminologist, civil rights attorney, professor of criminal justice, and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino, where he specializes in the analysis of hate crime, terrorism, and legal issues. Previously, Professor Levin served as associate director of the legal affairs of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Klan Watch Militia Task Force in Montgomery, Alabama, and he was also a New York City police officer in the Harlem and Washington Heights sections of Manhattan during the crack wars of the 1980s. He recently testified before Congress's Homeland Security Subcommittee on Counterterrorism and Intelligence. Welcome to Background Briefing, Brian Levin.
Ian, as always, thank you so much for having me.
Well, Brian, from my intelligence sources, what I've been able to piece together, and of course, this may not be accurate, but it certainly seems plausible that what happened in terms of these two shooters, what we're dealing with here, was that Well, if you go back to the father of the woman, he was a Pakistani from a Sufi family living and working in Saudi Arabia. He became a hardcore Wahhabi along with his daughter. That Daesh, the Islamic State, trolls the internet looking for impressionable American Muslims, and they found this young fellow out there in San Bernardino. And lured him to Saudi Arabia for the Hajj, where they set him up in what may or may not have been a honey trap with this woman, who he married there in the Grand Mosque in Mecca, which is pretty extraordinary in itself, indicating some sort of high level access. And the whole purpose was, of course, she was the trained terrorist. He is just the vehicle to get her over to the United States, which is apparently clearly what happened. Does any of that, and of course, during the shootout with the police in the SUV, she was the one that was shooting the police. He was driving the car. Not obviously, women in Saudi Arabia don't have driver's licenses. That may explain that. But she, from what I understand, she's the key to this, and she's the one that was trained as a terrorist. What are you hearing from local law enforcement?
Well, I am not I am not an intel person, and I really don't get into chatting up leads with local law enforcement. They have a job to do. I hear from people independently. Or anyway, bottom line is, I think there's enough out there. Let me just go to publicly sourced facts that I can discuss, and that is because I just don't talk about whether I talk to law enforcement, and if they do talk to me, what they say. But it's safe to say that I have not in this instance, okay? Yeah. Bottom line is, we have enough facts that are coming in fast and furious to indicate that she, at the very least, had a plateau with regard to very intense religious observance, even before she came here to the United States. What happened after she came here may very well hold a clue. Was it a honey trap where this was done in advance? Perhaps, but Daesh wasn't as active earlier as they are over the last year or so. So that's something to look at. But bottom line, I think that when we look to take the lens back a little bit, when we look at duos, it is usually, almost always, a dominant player who is much more radicalized. And I'm talking about across ideologies, by the way. Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols, for instance. A dominant player who takes a malleable and sympathetic to a cause person and then catapults them way into radicalism and extremism and then ultimately violence. Short answer, I think he married a terrorist.
And she was the shooter, though, wasn't she, in the SUV? He was driving the car. That's my understanding. Has that been verified by local law enforcement?
Again, let me just...
Yeah, I don't want to put you on the spot.
Well, also, I don't want to come off that, A, I'm talking to law enforcement, or B, if I am, that my information is coming from them. They have a job to do.
Right.
So most of what I do involves very publicly available sources. So just let me say that, because I don't violate confidences, nor do I talk to people to seek information from them. Okay? People might talk to me, but bottom line is... the publicly available information indicates that she was the shooter from the vehicle at the police.
So, Brian, let's talk then about your work, and you testified recently before Congress's Homeland Security Subcommittee on Counterterrorism and Intelligence. And was there anything that went on in those hearings that was sort of a precursor to this? I mean, how much... have we been blindsided? It would seem that this is a pattern here. Surely we got to be aware of it. I mean, there's so many similarities between this and the Tennessee shooter in terms of internet recruiting of these impressionable young Muslim American men.
It was chilling. And let me just just go right to some of the testimony. The next deadly mass attack, assassination, or crippling infrastructure sabotage may not necessarily come from extremist movements that have had more terrorist attacks or plots before, or even more or better trained adherents. Rather, the next terrorist attack will simply come from whoever is proximate, operational, and undetected tomorrow. And then I spoke about how Salafist jihadists and far-right extremists are the two most prominent threats, but not the only ones, with Salafist jihadists being the most prominent. But I also said, in today's splintered socio-political landscape, increasingly sophisticated organized groups also share the stage with angry, unstable, or disenchanted loners and with smaller informal groups. These latter actors may sculpt idiosyncratic hatreds online, become operational, and even recruit with little external backing. And then I talked about leaderless resistance and how information on how to commit such violence is widely available and an underground market for the tools of destruction exists. And then the last thing that I talked about was about ISIS and Salafist jihadists and how they have the most sophisticated internet training and recruitment operations.
And again, I'm speaking with Brian Levin, who's a criminologist, civil rights attorney, professor of criminal justice, and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino, where he specializes in the analysis of hate crimes, terrorism, and legal issues. Previously, he served as associate director of legal affairs at the Southern Poverty Law Center's Klan Watch Militia Task Force in Montgomery, Alabama. He was also a New York City police officer in the Harlem and Washington Heights sections of Manhattan during the crack wars, and he recently testified before Congress's Homeland Security Subcommittee on Counterterrorism and Intelligence. Now, you know the local imam as I do, Kuko, out there in San Bernardino. I've spoken at his mosque. He's one of the sweetest guys in the world. It's got to be agonizing for local Muslims. What do you hear about how local Muslims in your neighborhood of San Bernardino are dealing with this, Brian?
Well, they're obviously shocked, and let me just say, Dr. Mustafa Kuko, if you had to find someone who is the most antithetical to the cause of ISIS and one of the most peaceful and calm voices in our community, indeed a pillar of our community, you'd have to say it's Dr. Kuko. So obviously, I'm sure he's shocked. I'm sure his community is shocked as well. Look, one of the people that were shot was a congregant from Mr. Farouk's mosque. One of the emergency doctors who treated the injured and the dying is a Muslim physician. Of course, that's not going to get any publicity, nor will it make the hot air that is infecting our political discourse, which, by the way, is just what ISIS or Daesh wants. They call people who are Muslims here in the United States, in our pluralistic democracy, coconuts for wanting to live in freedom and liberty.
What's the analogy with coconuts there? Brown on the outside, white on the inside? Is that the...
I think just that they're naive and stupid.
Uh-huh.
I mean, they literally call them that, and they even have comic caricatures of them that they put forth over the internet, deriding Muslim Americans for their stupidity for embracing the United States and not joining their caliphate. But unfortunately, in this terrible atmospherics that we're in now, talking about setting up Muslim databases, among other things, and this whole kind of attempt by some in the mainstream political world to exclude Muslims from civil society is taking root with a decent percentage of people. For instance, 60% who say they would not vote for a Muslim for president. Or listening to one of the candidates saying about President Obama, there's something that we just don't know about him that makes him ineffective in the battle against ISIS.
Well, that, of course, is, you know, people forget that Donald Trump was the guy years ago talking about Obama. He led the whole crazy birther movement, saying Obama was a Muslim born in Kenya and had a phony birth certificate. So the racist implications there are pretty clear, along with the Islamophobic implications. So,
but
the president's going to have a hard job. Is that what you're thinking about tonight's speech?
The president is going to have a hard job because forgetting about the people who are part of an industry that has no quarter for him and will criticize him for all things, actual, perceived, or made up. The problem is there are people within his own orbit who have made, I think, plausible criticisms about his leadership with regard to the battle against ISIS or Daesh. And this is coming from someone who has great affection and admiration for the president. But when you have Leon Panetta saying that it's not an intel failure, it's a policy failure, and people who were formerly part of his inner circle in the intel area going on national television saying, yeah, they'll take one for the team, but at the end of the day, when there's conflicting intelligence, you have to make a decision, I think speaks a lot. Plus, his public statements come off very professorial, of course, coming from a professor. That's kind of hypocritical. But nevertheless, when he talked about in 2014 ISIS being a JV team, or the day of these attacks, saying that America is safe, or when there are announcements around Thanksgiving saying we have no credible threat, it looks to me that he's fighting last year's battle and not the current evolving fluid battle, which I so carefully, painstakingly laid out in testimony several weeks ago, only then to have it hit in our own backyard. It's chilling. And if he's going to double down on what's been done already, that's not going to be effective. 71% of Americans believe that President Obama does not have a clear plan with regard to combating ISIS. And his statements about containment and JV and safety and no credible threats is not resonating. People come up to me all the time from different ends of the political spectrum saying they do not trust the current effort to keep us safe from ISIS-related terrorism. The interesting thing here is these folks involved in this attack, these terrorists, at least from the evidence we've seen, seems to indicate ISIS's influence was not a direct orchestration, but rather a radicalism by proxy through the internet. Let's see how far this web goes. Right now, it looks like it's just a duo, but that's part of the battle. ISIS would love to send organized, trained fighters and orchestrate devastating attacks, but they're also happy to get singles and doubles as long as people are murdered. And that's the thing that I think that we're missing. You can block people from coming into the country, you can try and hit their command and control structure, but trying to combat an ideology, particularly when there's a catalytic civil war with a complete implosion of governance, is crucial. And the fact that we have that instability in that region and no political solution, the longer that occurs, those embers are going to hit all over the world.
Well, it's possible, though, given the ordnance that they gathered in their apartment with all those pipe bombs, that they had other plans and that something had happened in that at that Christmas party that may have triggered the male shooter to sort of go postal. That's one of the theories that they may have just...
If that were true, right. it suggests a lack of proper training and orchestration.
Right. Which I think the assumption is that maybe they was planning something bigger, but something intervened and they went for this. It's
I think they were. They were planning something bigger.
Right. But at the end of the day, just in the last couple of minutes, Brian, it seems to me though that still, in spite of what you said about the president's deficiencies so far. Nobody much in this country puts all of this in perspective in terms of, for example, going back to Bush and Cheney, when they equated bin Laden as the greatest threat since the Nazis. I mean, for God's sake, we survived, 30 plus years of every city in this country being targeted by nuclear weapons around the clock on a hair trigger. It's a miracle we survived a nuclear war during the Cold War. We had a real enemy, the Soviet Union. These guys are nothing compared to the real enemies that we faced. So we shouldn't, and I think still the statistics would indicate you still, as an American citizen, have a greater chance of being struck by a meteorite than you do by being killed by a terrorist.
Yes, except for a couple of things. First, with regard to Moscow and the Cold War, there would always be a return address, and these were not apocalyptic theological extremists. If anything, the Russians, the Soviet Union, were pragmatists. And what we have here is an apocalyptic religious quasi-cult that has taken over large expanses. And when they have land and they are able to train and operate with impunity, they have Mosul, a city the size of Philadelphia, and they have over $1 billion. This is a big deal, and the difference with respect to the Soviet Union is the Soviet Union was also in a battle for other places. Daesh wants to have an end battle against the West, and they are happy to kill people in a way that a traditional nation state wouldn't do because it would provoke a war. They want to provoke a war. So in some ways, I think we're at more risk from the average American is at more risk from Daesh than they were from the Soviet Union, because the Soviet Union would not bomb us unless we were in a total war. Daesh has an apocalyptic component to it that wants to engage us and wants to hit, wants to have low-level casualties. And that's the difference. And the other thing I would say is, yes, if we look backwards, the threat is certainly more limited. But what I'm saying, it's fluid, and ISIS or Daesh is interested in doing mass attacks, and that was something Zarqawi wanted to do in Jordan and expand out and never got an opportunity to do.
Well, Brian Levitt, I thank you very much for joining us here this morning.
As always, thank you so much for having me, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Brian Levin, who's a criminologist, civil rights attorney, professor of criminal justice, and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino, where he specializes in the analysis of hate crime, terrorism, and legal issues. Previously, he was served as associate director of legal affairs of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Klan Watch Militia Task Force in Montgomery, Alabama. He was also a New York City police officer in the Harlem and Washington Heights sections of Manhattan during the crack wars of the 1980s, and he recently testified before Congress's Homeland Security Subcommittee on Counterterrorism and Intelligence. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the challenges facing Homeland Security posed by the recent massacre in San Bernardino.
Until that day, the dream of lasting peace, world citizenship, rule of international morality, will remain but a fleeting illusion to be pursued, but never attained. Now everywhere is war.
Welcome back. This is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is David Shanzer, who's Associate Professor of the Practice and Director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security at the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University. Previously, he was the Democratic Staff Director for the House of Representatives Committee on Homeland Security and served as the Legislative Director for Senator Gene Carnahan, Counsel to Senator Joseph Biden, and Counsel to Senator William Cohen. And his positions in the executive branch included a special counsel to the Office of the General Counsel and at the Department of Defense, and trial attorney for the United States Department of Justice. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Shanzer.
Happy to be with you, Ian.
And David, what's your sense of two things? One, the challenges facing Homeland Security posed by these recent massacres, but I guess in the more immediate sense, how is the president going to address this issue and calm the nation tonight in a political environment where paranoia over terrorist acts clearly can be exploited by nativists and racists, and particularly some of the politicians running for president of the United States?
Well, the timing of this is bad because we're in a hyper-partisan moment, and these challenges really require national unity, and we're not going to get that, especially at a time when, on both sides, but especially on the Republican side, the candidates are narrow casting their message to a very small sliver of the electorate, primary voters in small states, Iowa, New Hampshire. So that's unfortunate. It makes the president's challenge a lot more difficult. But listen, he needs to assure the United States, the people of the United States, that our effort against ISIS abroad is robust and smart. And he has to explain why it's both. I believe there are, continue to always be things we can do to continue to put more pressure on Daesh. And put greater effort into that. But we can't make the giant strategic mistake of doing exactly what Daesh wants, which is to put large numbers of American ground troops in a Western-only invasion of Sunni territory in Iraq and Syria. I think that would be a long-term disaster, and I believe the president has been correct to resist that for quite some time now.
So in terms of proportionality, do you think the proportionality argument is going to work, that we have a greater chance of being struck by a meteorite than being killed by a terrorist? And in fact, as you and your co-author of an article in the New York Times, Charles Kurzban, wrote that right-wing extremists have killed as many people in the United States as Muslim extremists in recent years, and possibly more.
You know, I think it is always important to put it in perspective, but no, I don't think that argument resonates with a public that sees the massive media coverage and feels vulnerable. So you have to speak to people's fears and assure them that we have a very rigorous set of efforts internationally, with our military, alliances with our allies abroad, use of law enforcement, protective measures through Homeland Security, and a strategy to deal with what is an ideological conflict as well. And I think a public that is assured that there is a strong plan and a lot of resources will, if we can prevent attacks in the immediate future, will buy into that.
So I guess the key to this situation in terms of what lessons learned, and there certainly are reflections or similarities with the Tennessee shooter in terms of him being, I mean, both of them had, for example, they had violent, abusive fathers, spent a lot of time as loners, you know, on the internet, etc. How do you target that particular, or how do you understand that particular journey from a young American Muslim with, you know, family trouble, home life troubles, if you will, alone, but nevertheless still has friends, goes to the mosque regularly. All of his friends at the mosque say he was just a regular guy, and all of them cannot believe what's happened. So how do you find a way to detect something that seems to be undetectable even by those close to the person?
Well, first we have to be honest with the American public and explain to them that some bad things, some violent events are actually, you know, not possible to prevent. And we unfortunately have to expect that we will have instances in this in the future, and we're going to take appropriate, prudent measures to minimize the risk as much as possible, but we can't eliminate it entirely. That's first. Second, you know, when we look backwards, when we have a set of offenders, and we look at them, and especially what we call these lone actor offenders, you're right. You can see a set of traits, a journey that they have traveled, and they include a lot of different types of attributes, like disconnection from family, peers, and friends, alienation, isolation, maybe signs of some form of mental illness, perhaps an affinity with weapons, and maybe some training. However, those characteristics are so generalizable that you can't look at the entire population of the United States or even subpopulations of the United States and say, okay, well, we can find people that have these characteristics and we're going to put all of our efforts on that individual. So, you know, what I'm left with really in terms of the best preventative measures is really to empower both communities and individuals to better understand this phenomenon and feel that they can have a trusting relationship with the authorities in a way that we have a lot more eyes and ears for an early warning system of these kinds of behaviors. You know, that is probably the best way and actually has resulted in what we have to say has still been a pretty darn good record over the 14 years since 9/11 in preventing these type of things.
And again, I'm speaking with David Shands, who's a professor of the practice and director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security at the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University. And previously, he was the Democratic staff director of the House of Representatives Committee on Homeland Security and served as a legislative director for Senator Jean Carnahan, counsel to Senator Joseph Biden, and counsel to Senator William Cohen. And his positions in the executive branch include special counsel to the Office of the General Counsel of the Department of Defense and as a trial attorney in the United States Department of Justice. So, but one thing, though, that you can do something about, and I think that, well, you should be able to do something about if it weren't for the NRA, and that's what the president obviously will bring up tonight, is the fact that, you know, you can ban people from flying on our planes because they're on the terrorist watch list, but they're perfectly free to buy firearms, and that both this fellow out here in San Bernardino was able to purchase firearms and have them modified, I believe, by a friend to shoot full automatic. And he spent an awful lot of time on the range shooting target practice, and so apparently clearly did the person down in Tennessee that shot up the armed services, killed armed service people in the United States. He had a similar background too, as we've discussed earlier. So those flags at least ought to be able to be dealt with. But I guess we're not living in a rational universe when it comes to the Congress.
Right. I mean, our threshold for addressing these matters and whatever it is, whether it's about surveillance, whether it's about access to firearms, our threshold for taking some action can't be, well, if we, you know, doing this will prevent every one of these acts. Because we know both Tennessee and San Bernardino, neither of these perpetrators were on the U.S. no-fly list. So no, would it have affected this act? No, it wouldn't have. But that doesn't mean that we can't. It's all about reducing the amount of risk in the many different ways that we can as much as possible. So it's just, you know, what can you say? It's just preposterous that an individual is too dangerous to be allowed to exercise what is a civil liberty to travel, but they are fully qualified to exercise at least what the Supreme Court says is another level of a civil liberty, which is to buy a weapon to protect themselves. That's really the essence of the civil liberty that the Supreme Court has identified. The Supreme Court has not identified a civil liberty, however, to possess the type of weapon that is really only meant and designed to kill lots of people in a small amount of time, and that's a military-style weapon. And, you know, what can you say? Until we want to get serious about reducing all these forms of violence, we have to take all these different kinds of measures that might make a difference.
So, turning to the broader foreign policy landscape, it seems to me that the two things that have contributed most to the problems that we're having, and if indeed this is a case of Daesh recruiting this woman in Saudi Arabia and then somehow getting him to come to Saudi Arabia and getting her to go back with him, although that's not definitive. I think, though, in the broadest sense, there's two points you can make, is that, at least suggest here. One is that it would seem to me that the Wahhabi influence over the direction that Islam has taken is quite profound, and it should be looked at. And I think it's difficult under these circumstances for people to basically challenge that. And two, the other thing is, I think that certainly the invasion of Iraq created a failed state, and arguably so did the toppling of Gaddafi in Libya. Not that anybody wants dictators, horrible dictators, to rule forever, but have we contributed, do you think, in terms of our foreign policy, in creating these failed states, which clearly are the breeding grounds for terrorism?
Well, I think our relationship with Saudi Arabia is fraught with difficulties. It has been for some time, but I also think that given the shale gas revolution and the changes in oil consumption and patterns, we actually are in a better position to try to assert our leverage over Saudi Arabia. And I don't understand why we don't do this more. We continue to be guarantors of the free flow of oil out of the Persian Gulf, guarantors of certain levels of security, guarantors of levels of armaments to Saudi and many of the other the Emiratis, other governments in the region. Yet we get very, we ask for very little in return. And I really believe that that fundamentally has to change. Why it didn't after 9/11, I'm not sure. But of course we know that the majority, vast majority of the hijackers there were all from Saudi. So we ought to be asking a lot more from Saudi Arabia, both in terms of assistance in screening individuals who want to come to the U.S. So the our visa process for people who want to visit here or emigrate here is going to have to be tighter in reaction to what happened. And we need more cooperation from the Saudis on that. And I believe we need Saudi troops on the ground. Right now they're saying, well, we're much more worried about fighting the Houthis because we see Iran as the biggest threat in the region, not Sunni extremism. And I say, well, you know, I think we should say, well, that's fine, and we're with you in trying to restrain Iran, but this is a big problem for us, and if you're our ally, you need to be with us in this fight against Sunni extremism, the kind we're seeing with ISIS. As far as your other claims, I mean, there's no doubt that the regime change in both Iraq and Libya has led to massive instability in the region, and you have to combine that with, of course, the Arab uprisings. So we are in a period of great instability and transition in this region, and I don't think we can expect to see that change in the near future. So we're going to have to learn how to manage it if we think we're that the United States, as powerful as we are, we really don't have the power to bring a massive change in a quick period of time to that region. And therefore, we're just going to have to try to manage this instability for, you know, probably decades.
Well, in terms of Saudi intervention in Yemen, a lot of analysts suggest that, that they're going to be turning that place into a failed state. Not that North Yemen has ever been stable ever, as far as anybody can tell. So,
well, we have a civil war going on there right now. So, you know, widespread civil wars, you know, I think in the word failed state are pretty close to each other. The government is their government forces are so weak that I think you do have a failed state in Yemen. We have hot civil wars in Libya, Syria, Iraq, and Yemen. If we're going to, again, try to manage this instability, this grave period of instability in the Middle East, you know, we need to take the steam out of the civil wars. So, you know, while the political rhetoric is all about destroying ISIS, wiping out ISIS, the main focus has to be a resolution of the Syrian civil war. And I would want to hear very much from President Obama how he plans to try to bring that about. What is the possible end state? What does the political settlement begin to look like in Syria? Because until that happens, we are going to have ISIS, and ISIS is going to continue to be strong because it is essentially the guarantor of Sunni security in Syria and Iraq. So until there is some sort of other guarantor of Sunni stability, the ISIS is going to continue to exist and be quite powerful.
Well, David Shanzer, I thank you very much for joining us.
Well, it's been a pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with David Shanzer, who's Professor of the Practice and Director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security at the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University. Previously, he was the Democratic Staff Director of the House of Representatives Committee on Homeland Security and served as the Legislative Director for Senator Gene Carnahan, Counsel to Senator Joe Biden, and Counsel to Senator William Cohen. And his positions in the executive branch include counsel to the Office of the General Counsel of the Department of Defense and trial attorney for the United States Department of Justice. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back and go to Caracas, Venezuela for an update on the congressional elections underway.
porque está viejo y cansado. Pero no se dan de cuenta que un corazón amarrado, cuando le sueltan las riendas, es caballo desbocado. Y si una potra la sana, caballo viejo se encuentra. El pecho se le desgrana y no le hace caso a faceta, y no le obedece a freno ni lo paran falsas riendas.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now from Caracas, Venezuela, is David Smildy, a senior fellow at the Washington Office of Latin America, specializing in Venezuela, and a professor of sociology at Tulane University. Professor Smildy has researched Venezuela for the past 20 years and has lived there for a total of 10 years, during which time he taught at the Universidad Central de Venezuela and the Universidad Católica Andrés Bello. He moderates the blog Venezuelan Politics and Human Rights. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Smildy.
Thanks for calling.
And the election is underway in Venezuela for the Congress, and there's an expectation that there may be a change of government, that the ruling party may lose. Of course, the executive branch is not up for grabs at this point, so President Maduro is still in charge effectively. But let's start with that. What role does the Congress have in terms of the separation of powers? You see, if Maduro's party loses the Congress, how much does that restrain him as president?
Well, it really depends. It's a Congress similar to most Congresses and most democracies. No, it's there to actually initiate legislation and also to hold the executive branch in check. And so it's really going to depend on how big the majority is, whether it's just a simple majority or a two-thirds majority or a 60% majority. So they all have different attributions. With a simple majority, at least what they can do is they can, they will have the presidency of the legislature, and they can control the debate. And they can also do things like bring in ministers of the cabinet ministers to interpolate them and ask them, about what they're doing. And so that's something that basically has not happened for many, many years, and it makes it difficult for citizens or anybody to know what the ministers are doing. So that would be a plus. If they were to get a more substantial majority, if they got a three-fifths majority, they could actually have no confidence votes against the vice president and against the ministers, and they do that twice, and they're forced to resign. So that would be much higher, much more power. If they were to get two-thirds majority, they could actually they can push forward constitutional changes. They could put forward a recall referendum against President Maduro immediately. But I think it's pretty unlikely they're going to get a two-thirds majority. I think the most likely scenario is they're going to get a simple majority.
Well, obviously there's a lot of frustration within the country over food shortages, inflation, and crime. But there's also still a lot of rural support for the ruling party. But in general, I'm wondering at what point, how long this rhetoric can continue, particularly from Maduro, where everything's blamed on the U.S. and on counter-revolutionaries, and he's still talking about 21st century socialism. But the reality is that you have a country with the largest oil reserves in the world, a country that has enormous real and potential riches, that seems to be so mismanaged that I'm surprised that the guy's still, in power. I mean, this is the real issue to me, is that, those that support socialism surely cannot justify this incompetence, because it gives socialism a bad name.
Yeah, I think that's exactly the issue for Venezuelans as well. No, the rhetoric hasn't changed really in the past 2 years since Maduro became president, and it's running a little thin. No, about 70% of the people don't believe his theories about economic war, his different conspiracy theories. And people are just tired, because the inflation is in triple digits. It could reach 200% this year. There's 80% scarcities of a lot of basic goods. And so people are really suffering and are really tired, and the government doesn't seem to have any kind of answers. Now, there's another side to this, and that is that the opposition has made a conscious decision to run a campaign that's a very sort of minimalist campaign, and just because because the government is doing such a good job of sabotaging itself, the opposition has had a minimalist campaign and let people come to it. Now, the problem is that that strategy has some risks on its own in the sense that people don't have a really thick identification with the opposition. And so what we're seeing in the past couple of weeks is that some of the undecideds and some of the independents are breaking towards Chavismo. No, no, once they get to a situation in which they have to vote, they have to choose, some of them are going to and then say, well, we trust these people more than the opposition because the opposition really hasn't reached out to them. And I think that explains quite a bit of the very aggressive rhetoric of Maduro in the past 10 days. This is a classic tactic of Chavismo to try to polarize the population, make them decide, you know, who do you think is going to represent your interests, us with all our flaws, or these people that don't talk to you or can't be trusted. And so we are seeing a slight movement towards Chavismo, so I think the election is going to be a little bit closer than some people think. You know, in the past month, a lot of polls have shown that the opposition is 20 to 30 points ahead. I think when the vote comes out, it'll look more like 15 points ahead. So I think the opposition is going to win. They're probably going to win a majority in the legislature, but it's probably not going to be as big of a majority, despite the fact that the government is doing so poorly. You know, in the end, people have a memory of Chavez, and there's quite a few sort of undecided that are breaking towards the government we're seeing.
And again, I'm speaking with David Smile. He's a senior fellow at the Washington Office of Latin America, specializing in Venezuela, and he's a professor of sociology at Tulane University and has researched Venezuela for the past 20 years and lived there for a total of 10 years, during which time he taught at the Universidad Central de Venezuela and the Universidad Católica Andrés Bello. He moderates the blog Venezuelan Politics and Human Rights, and he joins us from Caracas, Venezuela, where today an election is underway for the Congress for 167 seats in the National Assembly. And as David just said, the opposition has been way ahead in the polls, but that they've tightened a little bit because the opposition is not reaching out. They're rather just letting the country run on a referendum of how screwed up the government is and how they've screwed up the economy and not provided basic security since the crime rate is so high. I've actually spoken to a journalist down there, a friend of mine, who basically had death threats. And in a country where you have so much random crime, it's easy to have a political crime can be covered up as a random shooting, by a criminal. So it's a terrible situation, as far as I can tell, from my conversations with my friend. But how do you personally feel there? Is it that insecure?
Yeah, it really is. I mean, it affects everything you do. Just yesterday, I came into the country through the airport, and the airport that used to be at night at 10 p.m., the airport used to be completely full. Now when you come in at 10 p.m., there's hardly any flights that come in at that time. Now all the flights come in around noon or 2 p.m. So yesterday I was there at 2 p.m., and it was absolutely full because there's all kinds of people. All the flights have been reoriented because people don't want to come in at 10 p.m. at night. Now, there's lots of places in Caracas that have very little nightlife. When you would think that on a weekend they would have people in the streets and clubs and whatnot, the streets are just empty because there's so much insecurity. And this, the government has another aspect. They've really shown no aptitude or no ability to deal with crime, and I think that's another thing that really weighs on them among the population. The government doesn't seem to have any answers for the things that are really affecting them.
So, but still, there is a legacy of Chavismo in the sense that the late president still has some kind of attraction, even though his successor has proven to be so much in his shadow and hardly up to the task. Again,
polls that came out recently that were showing Maduro with 20% support show that 50% had a positive image of Chavez. So that means there's 30% of the population that still have a positive memory of Chavez, but that don't support Maduro. And so there definitely is this memory of Chavez, or at least people have this memory of how they lived when Chavez was here. And, on average, Venezuela had 5% growth during the Chavez years. And so it provided opportunity for a lot of people. And so people have that positive image. There's also, the state here, state media, has this constant 24-hour barrage of information that is pro-government and talks about the history of Chavez and Chavismo and makes a connection between Maduro and Chavismo. They also have pretty extensive control over the private media as well. And so I think that explains how, despite the really terrible, terrible conditions in Venezuela, now, Maduro hasn't gotten below 20%, and now it has gotten up to about 30%. If you compare the conditions to, for example, Brazil, where Dilma has 7-8% support, despite much better conditions than what we have in Venezuela, I think that shows, two things. It shows how important it is for this government to have such extensive control over the media, control over interpretation of the situation, and the legacy of Chavez. The great charisma of Chavez still lives on.
So at this point, though, given the state control of the media, and as you mentioned earlier, a lot of the constant barrage of propaganda is wearing pretty thin, faced with the reality that you can't get toilet paper, that you can't go out on the streets at night, and that, again, you have a country with the largest oil reserves in the world and enormous real and potential wealth that appears to have been squandered. I don't know how they've screwed it up as badly as they have. What's your explanation for what happened to all that money?
Well, it's amazing. If you look at the political economy right now of Venezuela, or the economic policy of Venezuela, really no amount of money, no amount of dollars would work, because they have this exchange rate that is 100 times inflated. The exchange rate on the official exchange rate is 6.3 bolivares for $1. On the parallel market, you can get almost 800 now. So that just creates these huge, enormous incentives for corruption. On the other hand, there's all kinds of prices that are controlled at this official rate. So, a liter of milk here costs about 5 or 10 cents. You take it across the border to Colombia, and it'll cost $1, $1.50. So you can imagine the incentives there are for contraband here. With these kind of policies, it really doesn't matter how much money comes into Venezuela. It would be squandered. It would go into corruption. It would go into contraband. It would go into everything except for going to the people. So, this is what has happened. Chavez already had a lot of these problems, these distortions in place. He, for years, had this combination of state spending combined with an overvalued currency, which meant that he could put in a lot of liquidity into the economy at the same time that there could be lots of goods that would be imported. Of course, this over the process of 10 years really undermined local production. Now we're at the point, and then Maduro comes along, takes power. He doesn't really have the charisma of Chavez. His only real attribute is the fact that Chavez nominated him. And so for him to sort of revise the Chavez policies, it's just really difficult. It would sort of undermine his being nominated by Chavez. And so what he has done is he's basically taken Chavez's policies and he's taken them to the reductio ad absurdum. He's not devalued, and now, Chavez frequently the currency was three times overvalued, two or three times. Now it's 100 times overvalued, 120 times overvalued. And so, he's taken Chavismo and he's basically sort of driving it into the ground. Chavez, of course, handed him a country that was on an unsustainable path. And what Maduro has done is just continued on that path until it's gotten worse and worse.
So what about external effects? They blame the U.S. for everything. My understanding is that the U.S. is, at least the Obama people, pretty much have a hands-off attitude. They're only interested in the drug issue now. And the Venezuelans have kicked out the DEA in any case. And, of course, the DEA were involved in arresting what is apparently a son, at least he was brought up as a son of the First Lady, along with a nephew in Haiti. And of course, externally, you've got the price of oil dropping like crazy, which really must be the biggest impact on the country in terms of its economic revenues. So where do you stand in terms of the average understanding from the Venezuelan people about what's happening to the country from abroad? Do they really believe that Obama wakes up every morning and decides that getting rid of Maduro is his number one priority?
Well, I think they don't, and I don't think they think about that a whole lot. I don't think that the United States has really much to do with this at all. I think this is an own goal on the part of Maduro. He comes up with all kinds of conspiracy theories. Of course, the United States has done a number of things. Last March, it put forward this legislation implemented legislation providing for sanctions that gave Maduro a noticeable boost in the polls for a while, but it also generated a sort of an about course on the part of the United States, in which they sent Tom Shannon, Undersecretary of Latin American Affairs in the State Department, to Venezuela to have direct talks with Maduro and other government officials. And that was a pretty functional relationship over about 5 months there. It's kind of been set aside since the Venezuelan government sentenced Leopoldo Lopez, an opposition leader, to 14 years in prison for his role in the 2014 protests. It's kind of been set aside. But I don't think they've had a whole lot of meddling. Of course, there was information that came out recently that the NSA had been spying on the state oil company, and that was certainly unwelcome. But definitely the external context is difficult, you know, is an added difficulty. It's important to remember that the 2014 protests happened for all these same issues, you know, because of scarcities, because of inflation, because of, these economic problems. At that time, oil was at $100 a barrel. So all of these problems existed before. But, of course, now that oil is down to $40 a barrel, it has just greatly accentuated. Now, what we would have seen is a slow deterioration over 5-6 years. Instead, this is all being compressed into a year or two because the price of oil has plummeted. And, of course, when the price of oil plummets like this, you know, it gives Venezuela less power in the region as well. No longer does Venezuela control this resource that's $100, $120 a barrel. Now it's a little cheaper, and it gives them a little bit less power in the region. As well, Maduro doesn't have the charisma that Chavez did. And so we're starting to see some of the regional powers, Brazil, Uruguay, Chile, express doubts occasionally, whereas they before had a very long leash with Chavismo. Now it seems to be a little bit shorter. So I think, you know, the economic situation is definitely difficult, but the basic problem is the economic policy. And the international context is getting a little bit more complex for Venezuela.
Well, just in closing then, David Smiley, what's your sense of, you've given us a prediction that the opposition will win the majority in the Congress, less of a majority than they would have otherwise won had they been more, you know, transparent and engaging, I guess, in their political dialogue rather than just count on the fact that Maduro screwed things up so much that he's his own worst enemy. But if there is a change in government, at least at the congressional level, do you expect a change in U.S. relations?
Well, I do think that the U.S. is watching this closely, and depending on how this election goes, you know, I think that will have a big impact on the U.S.-Venezuela relationship. So I think if these elections come off clean, and the government loses ground and recognizes the results, I think that should serve as the Venezuelan government should be recognized for that. And I think the U.S. should start working again on this active dialogue and work towards the exchange of ambassadors. If there are some other irregularities or very suspicious result, I think then it will be put on hold for a while. So I think there's a wait-and-see attitude, and I think these elections will have a big impact on the direction of Venezuela and U.S. relations.
Well, thank you very much for joining us from Caracas, Venezuela, David Smiley.
Okay, thanks, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with David Smiley, who's a senior fellow at the Washington Office of Latin America, specializing in Venezuela, and he's a professor of sociology at Tulane University. He has researched Venezuela for the past 20 years and has lived there for a total of 10 years, during which time he taught at the Universidad Central de Venezuela and the Universidad Católica Andrés Bello. He moderates the blog Venezuelan Politics and Human Rights. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts, and also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.